Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. At long last, spring has arrived, and the thoughts of many have turned to golf and the Masters Tournament. What better time to talk about the history of golf, which is exactly what we will do after we take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. As a child, future baseball Hall of Famer Jackie Robinson was notorious for his feisty temper and tenacious determination. During this week in 1947, those character traits came in handy as Robinson became the first African-American Major League Baseball player, debuting as a second baseman for the Brooklyn Dodgers. A four-sport standout while attending college at UCLA, Robinson's weakest sport was baseball. Nevertheless, after serving in the Army during World War II, Robinson played professional baseball with the Kansas City Monarchs in the Negro Leagues. At about the same time, Dodgers owner Branch Rickey became convinced that African-American ballplayers had much to offer the game, athletically and economically. In 1945, he began scouting the nation for a black player that possessed both the talent and charisma to usher in a racial revolution, and he found both in Jackie Robinson. In spite of the physical and psychological abuses that Robinson endured upon first entering the league, he played for the Dodgers for 10 seasons, leading the team to 6 pennants and 1 world title in 1955. Turning items of historical interest in the news, a quarter of a century after the conclusion of the Vietnam War, the communist government now in control of that nation is planning to commemorate the site that marked the beginning of the end of the conflict. Recently, over 1,000 spectators and guests looked upon the streets of Bon Matu, a city captured during the communists' final victory push in 1975, as a military procession replete with banners and other patriotic memorabilia marched by. While Vietnam is on record as a nation trying to forget such a destructive episode in its history, leaders have found it important to hold such open displays of national pride as a way to rally a broken, despondent people. Over the next few months, the government has planned several memorial parades, including a procession marking the communist capture of Saigon. After starting his work in the historical boat business over 10 years ago by building a replica of the ship used by explorers Lewis and Clark to sail up and down the Mississippi River, A.C. Butch Bovier of Iowa has found it necessary to come out of retirement in order to prevent his replica from deteriorating like the original. Finished in 1988 by Bovier and his few associates, the vessel named Friends of Discovery by its builders has taken part in the annual Lewis and Clark State Park Festival in Onawa, Iowa. Upon leaving the project in 1996, Bovier instructed his co-workers on what measures to take in order to preserve the replica. Unfortunately, the project proved too difficult to maintain, resulting in the vessel sinking in shallow water after the 1997 festival. In spite of the costly task ahead, Bovier and his team of volunteers are confident that the Discovery will soon be making history again. You're listening to Talking History. Golf has become one of the most popular sports in America, and the Masters Tournament, one of golf's best-known events. Here to talk about the history of both is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik and his guest, Peter Kessler.
Thank you, Brian. Annually, during the second week of April, golfers from around the world compete in the Masters Tournament at Augusta, Georgia. Here to put the game and the tournament in historical perspective is Peter Kessler, host of the popular Golf Talk Live program on the Golf Channel. Welcome, Peter.
A great pleasure to be with you.
Thanks. When did this Masters tournament begin?
In 1934, and it began a few years after the greatest player of the time, Bobby Jones, won what was for him the Grand Slam in 1930, the capturing of the U.S. and British Opens and the U.S. and British Amateurs. When he won all four of those in the span of just a few months, in a single golf season, He knew that he had done everything that he could accomplish in golf, and at the age of 28, he announced his retirement from competition. Later that year, he was introduced to a piece of property a couple of hours' drive from Atlanta, Georgia, in Augusta, that used to be the largest plantation in the South, called Berkman's Nursery. And it was for sale. It had 1,300 varieties of apples and 900 varieties of pears on the property. And when Jones saw it for the first time and looked down upon the hugely sloping property, he thought, well, someone's just been waiting to come along to lay a golf course on this incredible piece of land. And so he built this golf course, which was intended to really be a getaway in the winter season, and it was much milder in Augusta than in Atlanta, and he wanted a place for he and his friends in absolute solitude, away from the glare and spotlight, to play in private. It was later suggested the course was so wonderful that it maybe should host a U.S. Open, but June is not a good month for a golf course in Augusta, and so that was set aside, and they ultimately determined that it might make sense for Jones to invite the great players of the game and the players that he had played with only a few years before to an annual invitational tournament. And he resisted the notion of the description of the tournament of the Masters as being too pompous. He also didn't want to play in it, but as the host, he felt compelled, as a Southern gentleman, to play in the golf tournament. And it was an instant hit. All of the sports writers who had been down in Florida for the beginning of the baseball season, and really the Grapefruit League, which it was called at the time, would be traveling north, and it was a perfect time of year for them to be able to stop at Augusta. And so the best sports writers were there, the best players were there, and Jones was the most golden hero of the golden age of sport, and therefore it's easy to see why this thing became an instant hit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say Jones built it. He was an amateur. He didn't really win money playing golf, did he?
No, but he was the best player in the world with really nobody in second place. I mean, for example, the two best professionals in the 1920s were Gene Sarazen, who won 7 major championships, and Walter Hagen, who won 11. From 1923, when Jones won his first of 4 U.S. Opens, neither Hagen nor Sarazen ever finished ahead of him in a major championship in which they were all eligible to play, which would be essentially the U.S. and the British Opens. Jones ultimately won 13 major championships, 4 U.S. Opens, 3 British Opens, 5 U.S. Amateurs, and a British Amateur, which he won in 1930, the year of his Grand Slam. So while he didn't accept prize money, he was the best player in the world. And if it was an amateur he was playing against, the amateur was thought in a 36-hole match to never be able to get past 30 holes with Jones, and that was usually true. And in 1927, to give you an example, when Tommy Armour, the professional, won the U.S. Open, that summer he and Jones played a series of friendly matches, and Jones was so much better than the U.S. Open champion that he would start the U.S. Open champion one up for each 9 holes. That's not a shot for each 9. That's starting him one up for each 9. And Tommy Armour lost money to Bobby Jones, the best player in the world.
Well, in terms of money, now, I mean, building a golf course costs a lot of money. And if Jones is an amateur and not winning professional prizes, was he independently wealthy, or did he put together a consortium of backers?
Actually, a consortium was put together, and it was put together by a Wall Street man by the name of Cliff Roberts, who ultimately, with Jones, started the golf tournament and ran Augusta National until Cliff Roberts' suicide death in 1977 and Jones' death in 1971. The two of them formed and ran Augusta National and the Masters, and Cliff Roberts, being a Wall Street man and a successful one at that, was incredibly well-connected, and at the mention of Jones's name, people would gladly pony up money, even though this was the beginning of the Depression. I think the golf course, the land, and the cost of it did not quite reach $100,000. And I think they had 365 acres, and Jones hired Alistair McKenzie, who had designed Cypress Point, among other great golf courses, as his architect and designer, but the two of them collaborated on this design. But Jones had no money at all. Jones was a lawyer. He had a degree in mechanical engineering. He had his master's in English literature. But he was so broke, despite the rumors, that he still had to live with his parents well after he got married in 1924 and very deep into the major championships that he would ultimately win. I think he lived at home with his folks until 1928 when he was 26 years old. So, contrary to popular belief, he didn't have money. He didn't come from wealth. And he was only able to go over to Britain in 1930 to play in those championships because it was a Walker Cup year where his expenses to play in Europe and to go over there and return home were picked up by the group of people that sponsored the Walker Cup every year. So Jones really didn't have the money and needed to get away from the glare and the spotlight for lots of reasons, one which was to begin to build up some assets, which he couldn't do as an amateur.
Mm-hmm. Now, the golf course that they built is referred to as a national country club and quite exclusive. How did they operate this as a business venture?
In order to be a member of Augusta National, you had to be invited. And it was supposed to be a golf course and a golf club for people who wanted to get away, who wanted a private place to be themselves, captains of industry, captains of Wall Street, celebrities, and it was by invitation, and still by invitation, that you are asked to join Augusta National. And so the idea was to create a club where from all over this nation of ours, members would be invited to have a diverse and eclectic membership.
Mm-hmm. And I remember as a young person being introduced to Augusta National because the golfing president, Ike, I'd see his picture on the sports page having played a round down there. What was that relationship?
Well, actually, that was his hideaway. And just like Jones needed a place to get away, so did the president of the United States. And so in the 1950s, his friendship with Bobby Jones and his friendship with Cliff Roberts continued to flourish, and Ike went down and played some golf there, loved the quiet, loved the solitude, loved Jones, loved Roberts, and ultimately they built a cabin for him on the property called Ike's Cabin, which is still there, and he and Mamie Eisenhower used to come down very frequently whenever he could get away so that he could have some time down, and that was one of the great places for him to wind down. And, of course, it was at Augusta National that the relationship between Arnold Palmer and President Eisenhower began and flourished.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've used the terminology major, and today the Masters is considered one of the four majors. Who established this category, and what kind of criteria is involved?
Well, I think it's a little looser than that. You know, the first three majors are easy to see how they became the important championships because the first championship was the British Open, which began in 1860 when the best player in the world, Alan Robertson, had died the year before in 1859, and people were wondering who the best player was, so they decided to hold a tournament to determine that, and they held the first Open Championship in 1860. In 1895, they held the first United States Open Championship to determine the champion of the country. In 1916, they held the first PGA Championship to determine the best professional. So those three were three of the earliest tournaments, and certainly they became, for those obvious reasons, being open championships of the world or countries or professionals, why they would be so highly regarded. In the 20s and 30s, there were a number of other tournaments that were thought to be particularly important. The North and South, the Western Open were sort of considered majors, but as soon as Jones's tournament got off the ground, and it did so instantly because of his stardom and the fact that everybody showed up to play, and also because when Gene Sarazen made a double eagle in 1935, the second year of the championship, to help himself into a playoff that he ultimately won, that too helped to establish the Masters. But the answer to the question of who establishes their criteria, I think it's a collective kind of a thing between players and fans, and at that time, most importantly, the sports writers of the day, who had much more clout than they do now. Writers like Paul Gallico and Grantland Rice were hugely influential figures and huge admirers of Jones in the golden age of sport in the 1920s, and so anything that Jones attached his name to took on special importance instantly. But when he put his name on a tournament that started off so successfully and, of course, that people loved instantly and that really kicked off the golf season in early April, you know it's spring when the Masters begins, so it's easy to see in hindsight how all of those factors combined to cause people to think, this kicks off the season, this is Jones, everybody shows up, this is one of the major championships. And ever since, really, 1936 or 7, this has been firmly entrenched as one of the four major championships of golf.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, associated with it are its colors and the green jacket. When did that begin?
The green jacket began, I believe, in 1949 when Sam Snead won one of his three Masters tournaments. I think he won it 49, 52, and 54. And it was decided to make an article of clothing, a jacket for the winner, and he was the first one to slip that on in 1949. And you're allowed to keep your jacket for a year, take it home with you when you win, and then it goes back into a locker at Augusta National, and you're only to wear it during Masters Week when you're there.
Ah. Now, you mentioned Snead and three victories. I mean, if we were to compile a Masters Tournament Hall of Fame, who are some of the people that would be in it? I mean, did Bobby Jones ever win his own tournament?
No, but you have to remember, of course, that he had been retired for four seasons, only played casual golf in the four-year interim, didn't have any interest in playing in the tournament, but again, as a southern gentleman of manners, he felt compelled as the host to play. The best he ever did, I believe, was a tie for 13th, and that may have been in that very first playing in 1934, and he realized instantly, like just two holes into that first round, that whatever magic that he had possessed, whatever zone he had been in, was now gone, and it was gone forever. That the touch wasn't the same on the greens, that the feeling of confidence wasn't the same, that the detachment what was going on around him had completely changed, and he was no longer in competition the player that he had once been. And he had felt when he had been playing that he was under enormous pressure from friends who would bet on him because he was even money to win any championship in which he played. So Jones didn't ever win his tournament, but certainly you would include him in the Masters Hall of Fame for reasons we've gone through already. And then in terms of players, you'd have to start with Jack Nicklaus, who won the championship six times. Nobody else did that. Jack won it in 63, 65, 66, 72, 75, and, of course, in 86, his 20th major championship. Prior to Jack's domination of the tournament, Arnold Palmer, with four wins, would be the next man that you would include. That's where Arnie became the Arnie of Go, Arnie, Go, and where he established his reputation as an aggressive, swashbuckling combination of sort of James Dean and Marlon Brando in the 1950s. And then you've got a few players with three wins. Jimmy DeMeritt and Sam Snead have won the tournament three times. Gary Player won the tournament three times. So those would clearly be Nick Faldo has won the championship three times. Greg Norman, you might even put in the Hall of Fame. He's won it no times, but he's figured in so many of them, 86, 87, 96, 99, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple of others, but he has been a dominant competitive figure at that championship, a tragic one in that he's never won it, but certainly his career and how we think of him is very much tied to his performances and the things that happened to him, most of them bad, at the Masters Tournament.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the minute or so that we have left, the beauty of the Masters is always alluded to. For you, what do you think is the special aura of the Masters Tournament at Augusta?
Well, if you're lucky enough to have ever gone, It's one of the few things in life that lives up to or exceeds your expectations and anticipation. It's more beautiful than it looks on TV. The holes are more wonderful than they appear when you watch them on television. The elevation changes are so much more dramatic than you might imagine watching the golf tournament on television. The 10th hole is almost a vertical drop, and the 18th hole is an almost vertical, out-of-breath kind of a climb. The size of the greens are small. There's not a piece of garbage on the property. The sandwiches are less than $2 a piece and are wrapped in green paper, and you get free pairing sheets. The whole thing oozes of dignity and class, and old-world charm in every meaningful sense of those words. And, you know, almost all of the great players in the history of the game have competed there, and most of those players have won there. And, you know, like the course that you might play on the weekends, we who love golf, who watch golf on television, know the Masters Golf Tournament, know Augusta National's golf course as well as we know the one at home, because it's the same one every year, and it's the only championship that continues to play at the same venue season after season. We know where to go. We know where not to go. We know where the trouble works. We know where the birdies can be made. And so there's an intimacy that you get when you revisit this old friend every single year, and you recall all of the previous visits. And so there's a magic to it. And, of course, the Masters means it's the beginning of spring, which means it's dig your clubs out of the closet and once again try to find that career round that's been eluding you forever.
Well, as a golfer, I resonated with every word. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Peter Kessler, host of Golf Talk Live on the Golf Channel.
The Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia is one of the high points of any pro golfer's career. But as the former PGA pro Tom Siefman explains, it's not the tradition of the Masters that makes it great, it's the course and how it functions. Siefman, who played on the PGA Tour from 1985 to 1994, talks about why he believes the Masters Tournament is the most important championship in the world.
For me, the Masters is the number one major championship in the world. Certainly not because I played my best golf there. I didn't. I missed the cut at the Masters both times I played. The U.S. Open was the best major championship for me personally, as I finished in the top 23 times and the top 10 once. It's not because of tradition that I favor the Masters. All the major championships have great tradition. In fact, the much more established traditions of the PGA, the U.S. Open, and the British Open make the Masters look like a buy.com event. And neither is it the green jackets, the blooming azaleas and dogwoods, the tall Georgia pines, or that drive-up Magnolia Lane that inspires me. No, for me, it's strictly the function over form. It's simply how the golf course functions that makes the Masters what it is. More succinctly, Augusta National has a well-documented and undeniable history of identifying the best players in the world. While the other major championships vary the venue every year, the Masters has always played on the same course. It's not that that course hasn't changed over the years, it certainly has. But the combination of the original vision of Augusta by Bobby Jones and the architect Alistair McKenzie, and its either wise or fortunate evolution, has made this golf course almost unparalleled. Now let's examine some of those changes. First of all, virtually every tee has been moved back 3 or 4 times. Because of the many traditional U.S. Open-style courses don't have this flexibility, they tend to trick up the courses to try to make them resistant to low scores. For many years, Augusta officials tried to hide the fact they're doing this, feeling it was somehow a slap in the face to past Masters champions that they had to lengthen the course to make up for the stronger, younger players of the day. But more recently, they publicized the 2 or 3 changes they make every year. They've also rebuilt many of the greens and added bunkers and trees. And when they add a tree at Augusta, it's not a little sapling that grows into something significant in a few years. No, it's a 25-footer that's brought in with a crane. Of course, Mother Nature has accomplished some changes over the years as well. many of the massive Georgia pines, insignificant little plants in the 40s, are major factors today. I know Sam Snead once said he used to cut straight across the par 5 13th and hit an 8-iron into the green. Now Tiger Woods and John Daly even must play the ball around those 70-foot pines. The green speed is another great factor. Once about 8 on the stimp meter, they usually run 12. But to illustrate what this means is a putt that at 8 might play 3 or 4 inches of break, at 12 on the stimp meter, you might play 16. Of all these things, it's still the function of the course or the shot values that makes Augusta National the great examination paper it is. It rewards great play, yet forces you to play every type of shot. It allows you to recover from errant shots, yet brutally penalizes poor management. The player who wins is going to have to play every type of shot well. As in the years past, look for the best players in the world to be in contention coming to the last 9 holes, which is always where the tournament is decided.
You've been listening to former pro golfer Tom Siekman, and this is Talking History. For our site of the week, we continue our discussion of the history of golf and recommend to you one of the honored places associated with the game. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Werfman.
Just outside of St. Augustine, Florida, is a place called the World Golf Village, which contains the World Golf Hall of Fame. The exhibits in the village and at the Hall of Fame are designed to appeal to golfers and non-golfers as well. There are many traditional and interactive exhibits, including the 18-hole putting green, a challenge hole, swing analysis, and also see if you can sink a putt with the pressure of TV cameras, commentators, and crowd noise going on around you. You can also walk across a replica of the St. Andrews Swillcan Burn Bridge, as well as watch highlights of golf's greatest moments in the Great Moments Amphitheater. And there is plenty to do at World Golf Village.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, when's the last time you read about military blunders or mistakes in planning or in operations? Well, the History Channel is taking up that subject in 2 programs that will air back-to-back on April 22nd. A Bridge Too Far will examine mistakes made by Field Marshal Montgomery during World War II in deploying the British Airborne to take a bridge behind enemy lines, leaving the lightly armed paratroopers to battle 2 crack SS Panzer divisions. Immediately following, stay tuned for The Raid on Dieppe, which documents the Canadians' first action in World War II, an ill-conceived and disastrous raid on the French port of Dieppe that failed due to inexperienced troops and poor planning. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times for both of these programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when, for our special Easter show, we will take a look at the biblical historical figure, Eve. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I'm not going to be able to do that.